You know, personally, look, I mean, that's what I do. I mean, when I love investing in real estate. I just don't invest in real estate where I have to manage the properties and, you know, go find the deals and source the deals and get bank loans and do all of those things. And people that can do that, I have friends that do that. God bless them. They can do it. It's just not really my game to do.
Yeah.
And so this is, again, where you get into investing. It's like, I want to do things that not only that I enjoy, it's just not just about the rate of return. It's got to be something that is in alignment with my values, my goals and purposes, and that I have some affinity for. And, you know, I think people, unfortunately, just get caught up in the return game when it comes to investing, which I think is a bit of a mistake.
Hello and welcome to the Chriswell Podcast on iCode Media. Today I had a great conversation with Eric Miller. As always, I think Eric, this might be your third or fourth time on the podcast, but it was a lot of fun. I always like picking his brain about just kind of steadfast financial topics. He is a kind of a guiding light for a lot of clients in the profession. If you're a practice owner, reach out to him. Please enjoy our conversation. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, write a review, share it with your friends, and support those who support us. As you know, patients with vitreous floaters are often frustrated by their symptoms. The challenge as clinicians is to offer solutions for our patients for vitreous floaters that are effective. But more often than not, the options of YAG vitreolysis and vitrectomy are not practical because the benefits don't outweigh the risks. That's where Vitreous Health from MacuHealth comes into play. Previously on the podcast, I've discussed the FLIES study with Dr. John Nolan, and the bottom line is that I can be confident prescribing this for my patients with floaters because I can tell them a large randomized placebo-controlled trial found that after 6 months of supplementation with Vitreous Health, floaters were reduced in size by approximately 30%, and 70% of patients had an improvement in their symptoms. Vitreous Health has been great for my patients, and we really feel like we have a viable option to treat patients with vitreous floaters now that we didn't have before. If you're not utilizing Vitreous Health for your patients, reach out to your MacuHealth representative now. Young and emerging presbyopes can be tricky. These patients want and need additional help at near, but they can be resistant to solutions that create even mild distance blur. The MyDay multifocal lens has been great for our presbyopic patients. It allows those patients to transition into a multifocal more easily. We've had this lens now for long enough that we've been able to see how simple transitions can be from an adaptation standpoint from lower ad designs to higher ad designs. The MyDay multifocal material is CooperVision's softest one-day hydrogel lens and features Aquaform technology combining the unique balance of high oxygen permeability with natural wettability in one material. The result is a highly breathable lens that keeps our patients' eyes looking clear, white, and healthy. So if you haven't started utilizing MyDay multifocal in your practice, I'd encourage you to reach out to your CooperVision representative to get started.
When do you get to fly?
When do I get to fly?
Well, yeah, I mean, you said you get the benefit, you get all the costs, but you don't get the benefits. So like when do you start getting, I'm assuming the benefits already actually get to go up and.
That's the fun part. But yeah. So I finished the transition training today, and now like, you know, I'll probably see tomorrow morning if the weather's nice, I'll go fly. Nice. What's been really great is, hey boys, it's a great day. You want to go fly to Ames for breakfast or Manhattan for breakfast? And so I get to take some of the kids flying different places. And I've been able to do that for a year, but it's always a rental. So you got to kind of plan in advance, rent in advance. Well, now it's like the plane's open, you know, all we're paying for is fuel and turn time. So if I see a good day and my kids want to go someplace, then we just go. And then also, like for regional meetings that I go to, now I'll fly to them. So I've flown to, you know, for meetings in Rapid City and Scotts Bluff and Sioux Falls, Ames, Iowa. So it just kind of, it kind of expands the fun factor of travel. Yeah. And then as I get my instrument rating, then I'll go further. You know, because then once you don't have to worry so much about weather, I mean, you always have to worry about weather, but about like not going at all because the weather's too bad, you have more options.
So, my next question is then when can we expect the Gulf Stream?
I might need to work with you on some of my saving strategies to make that happen. You know, so in all of this, what's been a lot of fun is, you know, we haven't diverted anything from kind of our normal financial plan as a family. Mm-hmm. Gulfstream's probably out of the question, but,
never know.
Yeah. You never know.
Something
I suppose
could pop, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that kind of brings us right into the conversation today. It's like, you know, I had a conversation a few weeks ago with a gentleman. I'm not sure if you know him or if you listened to the conversation, but he was talking about passive income, and essentially the passive income he was discussing was, what it boiled down to was rental properties. Mm-hmm. And, what I walked away from hearing him, was, he said it was passive income, but I didn't view it as passive income once he described a few things. And so, you know, I'm not asking you to pit yourself against him. You probably didn't listen to I'm not asking you to kind of have a debate back and forth, but I just thought, that's a really interesting thing, but I don't know anything about rental properties. And it would seem to me to be like very active income, because you're worried about, well, is your property manager doing this? Is this happening? It's like, well, I don't know anything about that. And so, do you view passive, like, what do you view as passive income?
Well, I think the way I view passive income is income which you don't have to put any work or effort into and get a check in the mailbox, you know, so to speak, every single month. So while the idea of passive income sounds really, it sounds great. And there's certainly a lot of merit in diversifying and getting other streams of income that's not just derived from your going to the office every day and treating patients. But to your point, if you're going to invest in real estate and you're going to do it professionally, the right way, where it's profitable and that it's, you know, set up to reduce your liability, maximize your returns, it's going to be work. And it's going to be costs and all those things. You're going to have to put together a team to be able to do that. So it's not technically passive to that degree. I mean, if you like invested in like a REIT or maybe some other kind of private placement where you just give money to an operator and they do all the work, that's I would look at that as passive income.
So but then, but then your expectation on your return is going to be probably similar to what you might get in another investment opportunity that is more like a stock or other investment like that. Would that be accurate? Because you're already paying for a lot of the overhead.
Well, of course, you're going to have to pay someone to be an operator for this, and they're going to charge a management fee, and they're going to charge, you know, loan origination fees and all other kinds of fees that you would normally pay. But they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And is that worth it to you? Because where you make your money is in your practice, your real estate, and your entertainment or in your media company. You know, that's what you do really, really well. So I would continue to just pour fuel on those things, because they've probably been a much higher return to you than anything else, buying rental properties or anything like that would be. Because it takes a lot. I mean, you do have to spend some hours to understand that game and that world. And, you know, personally, look, I mean, that's what I do. I mean, when I love investing in real estate. I just don't invest in real estate where I have to manage the properties and, you know, go find the deals and source the deals and get bank loans and do all of those things. And people that can do that, I have friends that do that. God bless them. They can do it. It's just not really my game to do.
Yeah.
And so this is, again, where you get into investing. It's like, I want to do things that not only that I enjoy, it's just not just about the rate of return. It's got to be something that is in alignment with my values, my goals and purposes, and that I have some affinity for. And, you know, I think people unfortunately just get caught up in the return game when it comes to investing, which I think is a bit of a mistake.
Well, when you think about that return game, because he did bring up a point that I was interested in kind of exploring with you, was, you know, I always did hear the 4%, you know, your return is 4%, but he brought up the point that most investors, they may not talk about it, or most financial advisors aren't going to talk about it, but most of you are counting on a 3% return. And so then you start doing the math, and he did have a good point. All right, so like if I get $1 million saved away and I can take 4%, let's just say 4%, even let's assume that that's correct, then like I'm a poor millionaire, you know, in retirement. Like, yeah. How do you view that?
Well, I think the whole idea of a 4% withdrawal rate, like first off, they call it a safe withdrawal rate. That's the term that the industry uses. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're taking from an account and not putting into it, you're going to start seeing that account value go down. What the hell's safe about that? There's nothing safe about that, whether it's 3% or 5% or 7%. So the target is that you're not going to run out of money. Well, who wants that stress?
Dude, I've been thinking about that a lot. Yeah.
Do you want that stress?
No. I don't want to see my account. Even now, like when I have money coming in, if I see an account, if I make a, you know, write a big check to pay for some of the building that's getting built, right?
Yeah.
And I see that money coming out, I know I've already planned for it. I mean, psychologically, I've planned for the money. I know it's where it's going. It's in there for a purpose. And then I write the check and I just, I feel it. Maybe I'm weird, but that's I worry
like,
about.
It's like
that.
A loss of a limb, isn't it? You're like, I just lost my right arm, and hey, I get it. This is the, you know, this came right out of the Retirement Planning 101 book. You can read any CFP book out there, and this is exactly what it says, and it's based upon something called the wage replacement ratio, which basically means that you need to save enough money in retirement accounts that will replace, you know, 60 to 70% of your current income, and then only take 4% of that safely, and you shouldn't run out of money. It's the barest bones minimum, but yet that is the target that most people are operating on, which goes back to my fundamental principle is that most people are grossly underestimating how much they actually need in income, assets, and resources to be able to live the life that they want to live, stress-free of money.
Okay.
And following that advice of, I'll just do 3 or 4%, I'll have enough in retirement accounts to replace 60 to 80% of my current savings, it's just a wrong target. It's a wrong target. So I think that that's where you have to first realize that, recognize that, confront that that's probably not what I want, because I want to have extra money. I want to be able to go fly. I want to be able to go take, you know, $10,000, $20,000 vacations with my family. And I want to do it in a way where I never see my net worth go down. I just want to see it continue to go up, because I've heard people say, I just want to die writing my last check, out of my account or something like that. And I'm like, that's pretty selfish.
I've heard people say that.
Yeah. And I'm like,
yeah, I've heard people say that.
And I go, that's selfish. Like, why? It's my money. I was like, I get it. But, you know, you can also direct that money to do good. And why would you want to put yourself in peril like that, or your family in peril, by not having enough? So,
comes down to the practical aspect of, like, nobody knows when they're going to, when that last check is written. Yeah. And it's gone. Like, okay, well, I got 5 more years. You know, you don't know. You can't know that.
You would have to have the most miraculous timing of anyone ever. The probabilities of that are probably slim and none.
And it takes you down a path of, like, very, if that's really what people think, which I don't think it is, but if it really was, it would take you down a pretty dark path. Because then once the money's out, then does that mean I've got to expire too? And then, like, what are all the consequences of that morally and ethically on your family? And
what's wrong with
nobody really means it.
No. If you teach your kids well with money, I don't have any problem then, you know, making sure they recognize, hey, you know, I did well, but this is why I have a lot of money. If you communicate that to them, if you, you know, explain and really teach them the basics and fundamentals of where this came from, they're going to respect it, I think, to that degree. Most of them will. You'll hear horror stories where it doesn't. But, you know, I think that that then can then, you know, you can use that money for, they can use that money and build a legacy or whatever they want to do. But yeah. I just don't think that most people want to be under the stress of just barely getting by. And that's the target. I mean, I have for all of our clients is like, I always tell them, I don't ever want to see your net worth go down. I don't think it needs to, even when you don't have the practice anymore.
You can kind of tell, at least I feel like I can tell. You know, I've never asked somebody like outright about their finances, you know, that they've got sitting around. But I'm in a business group, a Catholic business group called Legatus. And I was at my wife and I were at a meeting. It's been great because we go to a it means ambassador.
Okay.
And so a lot of the people that are in this are like very, very like they're couples. And we looked at it like, well, we'll be able to be with other Catholic couples who've run successful businesses over their time. And in theory, and I think this is practically true, is that they've followed, ethical business principles that align with their faith and our faith. And so, so obviously that's not that could be false in certain instances, but I think by and large, that's kind of how the group tries to select people who are going to be members. And, you know, we've been there for 4 months. So we meet every month and we look at it like, it's a nice date night and we can go meet other people and talk to other people and hear a good talk. And, but like I was talking to somebody last night and like, you just knew like their concern about running out of money was zero. You know, they've been retired for 5 years but he came in a kind of a collared shirt, maybe like something you're wearing, a t-shirt underneath it. He looked nice, but he didn't look like he had just was dripping with money. He didn't present that way. He didn't want anybody to think that. But like when you talk to him about what he can do with his family, and he's just talking about, you know, his grandkids and his son just moved back and they can do this thing. It's like, this guy's not worried about money. And he's not trying to be flashy. He's just, you know, this is who he is, and he's got retirement. He does the stuff he wants to do, and he gets to hang out with his wife. Like, that's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. And he's probably, and I think he probably understands the fundamentals of money, and he understands that maybe life isn't all about money too. And that what's the purpose of money if you don't have good health or you look good or you feel good about yourself? I mean, there's a lot of other things. It's fascinating to talk to people that are in good financial conditions of, you know, where they got it, where it came from. But, you know, you're right. You do see this peace and ease of these people when it comes to the subject of money. They're not like tense. They're not like, oh my God, I'm afraid, or I'm worried about the markets all the time, or I'm always watching my account values or anything like that. You know, they've set themselves up in a position where they feel at cause over their financial condition. And they know that regardless of what happens to the outside economy, look, you can always create something again. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people, especially that we've seen, that you lose the belief that you can actually create something again, then you really are on a short road to kind of death and dying at that point in time, because now it's just what you have and that's it.
Do you think the people that you work with, is it learned behavior, or is it something that anybody could learn? Because I do think that's true. Like, once you meet a lot of like high earners or people who have started businesses, what I've noticed is that if they do it multiple times and they're successful multiple times, they stop worrying about whether or not they could do it again. You know, some of them, not in this group, I don't know about this group, but you think about the people who are like, they might have been sued. You know, I think about a doctor that gets sued,
or
a doctor that sells a business,
like,
or divorced, or something. It's like, and it's like they. I mean, it's the worst thing. You don't want it to have happen, but you get to a point where it's like you've been around long enough. You know, you do the right things. You're trying to take care of people. You're trying to be a good steward of the dollar. And if something happens that kind of collapses that system, it's okay, because I can just rebuild. Like, what's the worst case? How do people get into that mindset? I'm not there. You know, I do all the things you're talking about. I check the bank accounts. The bank accounts for the office, I check them. You know, I lose sleep if they get below a certain number. And we've talked about this. I think the last time we talked about it, it's like, you know, so how do people get into that mode?
I think it'll just come at some point in time with you where you'll look back. And I'm okay with you being on top of all of that. honestly, because I think a lot of people don't confront the area and they don't look and they don't inspect. And I think those things that you do are things that a lot of people should do. And people that have money do those things. But there is going to come a point where you're not going to feel like the tension when it comes to that. Like you're just going to have a, like I said, just some moment of serenity, financial serenity, that that you'll know, like, okay, I've checkmarked all the boxes here, and you know, I've done what I'm supposed to do to protect my family, and that, like, I don't know when that's going to happen to you, but I think it will. But I like the fact that you have that urge and impulse to do all those things, because you know, there's a lot of people that have the exact opposite impulse.
They just bury their head.
Yeah, and they don't confront, they don't do it, and you know, unfortunately, we see that in a lot of, you know, a lot of practice owners that do that. They don't look at the finances, they don't pay attention to these things, they don't pay attention to their money, and they get ripped off, they get money, and you know, we've talked about just, you know, what happens to money when you don't pay attention to it. It will go everywhere. And setting up systems so that you control the money is you know, why people have financial success. So that's okay, man. You're not
Thanks. The counseling session.
Feels like it.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it might be fun. I don't know. Did you have something else that you I got an idea of where I want to pick your brain. You didn't have an agenda today, did you?
I think that withdrawal rate was really the only thing that I want to just really get people to see that things that you know you're talking to your advisor or your financial team, you know, about how much you're actually going to need. I just want you to, like, not base it upon you running out of money. When you're doing your planning, when you're doing, your financial planning of, okay, this is what I'm going to have from my retirement accounts, my real estate, my practice value, my practice sale, my, you know, my income from my real estate, whatever that is. Just make sure that you are setting a target higher than you taking all the money out and eventually running down to zero.
One of the challenging things with patients is that when they invest in a really high quality pair of glasses and customized lenses, occasionally it can be difficult to keep those lenses clean, scratch-free, and smudge-free. Now, we have the ability with Crizal Sapphire HR lenses to offer our patients a best-in-class anti-reflective coating that is also resistant to scratches, smudges, and deposits. This means that patients spend more time enjoying clear and comfortable vision and less time caring for their lenses. So remember that you can provide patients with the best in quality, best in class, transparency, clarity, durability, and UV protection in a single Crizal coating. If you want to learn more about Crizal Sapphire HR, contact your Essilor account executive or visit EssilorPro.com/Crizal. The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, how do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote-unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education, for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com.
That was the big message that I wanted to get across.
No, I think it's good. So I think it might be fun to play this out a little bit. Is like I want to use just a standard income of, like, if you look at, again, I get this number from recent articles surveying optometrists, and we'll use a number of 150. Okay, so let's say that's, now it might matter to you whether or not the doctor is a practice owner or not a practice owner. Do you need to know that to do this, to play with this idea?
Let's say they we can do both. I mean, okay, if we have time to do that. Let's say 150,000. Okay, what's the follow up to that? And let's say
they're a practice owner. Right. Mm-hmm. So they're probably, you know, their practice is generating, let's say that they're paying themselves like we've talked about before. Let's say they're paying mm-hmm. themselves as an optometrist and they're paying themselves as a business owner. And mm-hmm. the total amount of that revenue is $150,000. Okay.
Fair enough.
And let's say they've achieved this. Let's say they're 35 years old. Okay. This is not me. I'm 42. So I'm not projecting anything on here. I just want to kind of do the math, right? So you're saying, okay, well, how do we even start with the idea of like what do we need to do to get to that point where we're never pulling money out, and what's our expectation got to be?
Yeah, so I would start with is $150,000 now the target of how much income that would allow you to live the life that you want to live? Okay, so that's $12,500 a month. All right. That's my first question to that person. Is that enough? All right. And they may say no, they may say yes. Well, you know, and assuming I don't have any debt or I don't have any other expenses, because right now at 35 years old, that $12,500 is getting eaten up by student loans. It's getting up by, you know, paying off your home mortgage. It's getting
practice loans. Kids, yep.
Kids expenses.
Yep, kids to school.
And,
yep.
And all those things. Okay. Well, I'm not going to have that in maybe when I'm 60, but I'm going to have new expenses that are going to replace that, because I'm going to want to travel. I'm going to have probably long-term care. I'm probably going to have to take care of my parents. You know, there's other things that are going to have to you know, be in that equation. So, you know, I'd probably say to that person, like, what do you think an ideal income would be for you based in today's dollars to live the life that you would want to live? Okay. Probably not $12,500. It's probably not enough. So they're probably going to say, oh, $20,000 sounds great. So I would say, okay, great. So $20,000. So that's $240,000 a year. Tracking with me? So how much would I need in total assets of everything that I have, on average, generating a 5% rate of return? I mean, some of these investments are going to perform better than others, but on average, if all of them are producing a 5% rate of return, then how much am I going to need in total assets to produce $240,000 a year?
Yeah.
And the answer is $4.8 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot more than most people think.
A lot more than most people think.
Chris's point that on the podcast month ago or so, which I was staggering, was something like, you know, some very small fraction of all investors have even $1 million, you know, saved for retirement.
It's true.
So, yeah.
So I just shocked the heck out of a lot of people right there when I said that. Again, this person's only 35 years old.
Yeah.
Okay.
But $4.8 million is a lot of money.
It is. But when you think about, if that person has making $150,000 on a practice, that's 20%. That means they're doing $750 in revenue on that practice. 20%, 750, yep. I think is 150. Okay. So what can I do now to get that practice value? I want the practice to maybe, you know, I got, I don't know what, 20 years to run this practice of 55, you know, maybe to 55 years old.
Yeah, easy.
Can I get it?
Easy.
Can I get it to $2.5 million over that time frame in revenue? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be work, but can hire some doctors. Well, $2.5 million practice at a 20% profit margin.
Yeah. Now, you're talking, what, now, 500,000?
Yeah.
It's a different story.
At an 8 multiple, there's 4 million right there. Or even 6, you know, it's 3 million. Okay.
Yep.
And then along the way, I acquire my practice building. And that practice building at some point in time is probably going to feed me between $8,000 and $12,000 a month.
Yeah, fair.
So I've just covered now 12,000 of my income, you know, along with the so it's not unreasonable at all. You just have to plan this out and think of what I'm going to do to be able to create that lifestyle that I want. And, you know, we find that a lot of people can do that, but they've just never been presented with the right numbers. And, you know, what's a logical path on how we can do that? Well, there's nothing there's nothing logical about it when it starts. It starts with a belief and idea that I actually can do that. Okay.
You've heard me talk about beliefs, haven't you? Maybe you haven't. But I'm all over them.
Yeah. I think you're a kind of guy that I think when you have an idea or you make a postulate or everything starts with that idea, right?
Yeah.
And it goes from there. Now, how much power you put behind that is the doingness, how much work you want to put into it. Because you just can't, like, I mean, if I could just manifest, you know, $40 million, I'd be doing that right now. Right. Doesn't quite work that way. But you can definitely, like, you know, it is going to start with an idea and belief in yourself. And then, I mean, I'll ask you a question, even though I probably shouldn't.
Sure. No, go ahead.
How much has your confidence went up as a practice owner, as an investor, as, you know, someone that's now got a pretty popular media company in this space? I mean, how much has your confidence went up over the last 7 years?
I have to control it. Yeah. I mean, I think it's gone up a ton. It's gone up a ton. And I find myself now trying to check a lot of those things to just step back and say, like, is my perception of myself, really what other people's perception of what I say, is that accurate? You're right. I mean, do I think I could, but I try to temper it a little bit, Eric, to make sure I don't think like, well, just cause I've done this, I can do that. I think that's one of the things I do keep at the forefront of my mind. I've never started a practice cold. So I've got a lot of respect for people that do it. And I've thought maybe I should start a practice cold, but also I'm like, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into that I want to put my work and effort in other places. So I would worry that I would sort of not have the inputs there. So I guess I've got a lot more confidence now, a lot. But I also think that part of that is a responsibility to me and my family is to just kind of check that to make sure it's what we're doing now is actually warranted that confidence.
Yes. And definitely, I think as people have more success, there is that tendency to like think that, oh my gosh, I'm the only one that can do this. And that goes down a pretty negative path, because I'm sure you could probably name, you know, a whole list of people that have helped you get there at that point. But hey, man,
totally.
you still did it. And it's evident, obviously, what's happening to you in your life and your financial life, that there's things that you can now do that you couldn't do 10 years ago. And, you know, you do have to kind of acknowledge yourself in that equation. You know, I start a lot of my talks with practice owners by telling them that having money is virtuous, it's divine, it's righteous, and it's actually, you know, something that you deserve and have a right to. But you got to be able to actually be in a condition where you're worthy of it. And a lot of people don't put themselves in that position. And I think, you know, you obviously have been able to do that. So, but a lot of people don't. They get told a lot of the times that, oh, well, you're only doing it because for the money, and you're not in it for the healthcare or the patients. Or, I mean, I am sure you've heard that along the way at some point in time.
I am aware that it could happen. I'm aware that people might perceive my message that way, but I'm also very conscious that could happen. And so I tend to make sure that because it's about taking care of patients. My whole point whenever I talk about how do you understand the financial aspects of what we do, it's so that we can take care of the patients that the way that we're trained to take care of them, the way that they deserve to be taken care of. And so the reason I talk about a lot of the financial stuff is because I want to remove these subconscious hold, like anchors that prevent us from doing things, because where we're worried about most doctors are not worried up here about the dollars. They're worried back here about the dollars in the back of their brain. And if they're not conscious of it, they'll they'll follow certain behaviors, and that will detract from the doctor-patient relationship, and it'll lead to less care. So I try to make sure that I'm communicating that on the front end, but I'll tell you that there are times where I don't. And if I don't communicate that when I'm talking about financial stuff, then it can come off as like, Chris, you just want to talk about money. And that's not true. I think it's just so important. It's so fundamental. You know, the economics is so fundamental. Behavioral economics is so fundamental to what we do and to our behaviors that that if we don't acknowledge our tendencies, then it prevents us from doing what we can do best. Yeah. So,
I think the term you were looking for is limiting beliefs that people have.
Yes, it's exactly
limiting
right.
Beliefs. That people have about money, and it is a something that as advisors we have to deal with quite a bit, in trying to change those limiting beliefs and really break that pattern. And you know, the thing that breaks that pattern is just getting in there and changing some of the systems or the habits that you have. And it does take time, but once you do it, obviously it's going to pay dividends for you. So but yeah, it is a struggle for a lot of practice owners. And that's why not a lot of them, I think to your point, really have, this is where we see guys that are still 70, 75 years old still practicing because they never really got control of or understood the financial aspect of running a practice.
Yeah. Well, listen, I've already delayed your time a ton today. So I'll be respectful of it. Again, as always, we'll have to do this again. Sure. We'll reach back out to you, and I'll be on time this next time. I promise.
That's okay.
Where
man.
Can people reach out to you, Eric? And so I'll give a plug. I have not used Eric personally, but Eric's given me a ton of advice over the last 4 years just from our conversations. And if you like what you're hearing with Eric, and somebody that's kind of steadfast. Resolved, understands kind of the pulls that happen within optometric practice, you should reach out to him. He's not a paid sponsor. I consider him a friend. I think it'd be fun to at some point be able to fly down there and hang out for a bit. But Eric, where can people find you?
Yeah, they can just go to econologics.com. That is the name of our firm, Econologics Financial Advisors, spelled econologics.com. And there's a whole website there that's dedicated to financial advice for practice owners, which is all we do. So that'd be a good place to start.
Awesome. Eric, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, brother. Be well.
You too.